From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump calls him Sleepy Joe, but the former VP continues to lead most early Democratic polls. This morning, Biden announced his formal candidacy. He begins with formidable name recognition and experience, but abundant skepticism about whether he represents where the party is going. We'll critique Biden's run right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. Things are looking very good for Joe Biden as he starts the formal part of his campaign, the former vice president running for the Democratic nomination. We're going to critique his run momentarily. Coming up a little later this hour on Take Your Child to Work Day, my son Desmond is going to be with me for a segment later this hour. We'll talk about the pros and cons of being an only child and open up the phones. If you're an only or you're the parent of an only, be interested to hear what you have to say about the experience. Desmond joins me coming up a little bit later. But right now, we begin with the formal announcement by the former vice president that he's in the race.
I believe history will look back on 4 years of this president and all he embraces as an aberrant moment in time. But if we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are. And I cannot stand by and watch that happen. The core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America, America is at stake. That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
And right in character, President Trump responding via Twitter this morning, "Welcome to the race, Sleepy Joe. I only hope you have the intelligence, long in doubt, to wage a successful primary campaign. It will be nasty. You will be dealing with people who truly have some very sick and demented ideas. But if you make it, I will see you at the starting gate." President Trump tweeting in response. Joining me to talk about the candidacy of Joe Biden, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist who joins us regularly. Matt, thanks so much. I mean, obviously, yeah. Joe Biden doing very well in very early polling and much of that name recognition. Everybody knows who he is.
Yeah. And this is typical of presidential races that you have to cover them in real time. And so where it's going to end up is not where you are now. And so everyone always wants to say, well, you're the front runner. What does this mean? You know, the votes aren't for 9 or 10 months. Look, he starts in a pretty good spot. He has just far, far more experience than anybody there. He's just sort of he's going to dominate the field from that point of view. Whether that's what voters want, we'll see. But he starts in a good place in terms of name recognition. He was Obama's vice president. No one's really injected Obama into this race at all. If you notice, you know, we're talking about it isn't like Obama was there 30 years ago. This was just, 2016 that he ended up leaving office. And so how Biden handles, you know, the legacy of Obama and is he the kind of handoff to that legacy and what that will mean for Democratic primary voters, I don't know. But that's my sense that that's going to be a big part of what his strength is.
He was asked this morning by a reporter about why President Obama wasn't endorsing him. Biden claimed that he had asked Obama not to endorse. You don't know whether that's an accurate characterization or not. But I mean, it typically, I wouldn't think a former president would endorse this early.
No, and probably wouldn't be appropriate to do so. And there's always sometimes, and I don't know about in this case, but there's always some tension sometimes between the vice president who's running. There was a little tension between H.W. Bush and Reagan and when was going to endorse and what happens. And not that there's necessary tension per se here, but Obama has a lot of people he's sort of representing at this point. He's a former president. There's a lot of people running. The party, every primary can be pretty divisive. They usually are. It's the nature of, you know, when you run, this is the competition, right? Everyone sort of always starts out saying we're just Democrats. We all love each other. But at the end of the day, you think the other guy's a jerk, which is why you're running and you want to beat them. And so I think he's smart. He needs to stay out of this thing. My sense is Obama's going to stay out well past Iowa and New Hampshire. I think what would get him in the race would depend on what the tenor of the race is and where it's going in the fall. And is, you know, would he jump in to stop a Bernie Sanders because he think that's problematic in the general, or somebody else, depending on where it's going. But I don't think we know any of that right now. And I think he's smart to stay on the sidelines and wait this out for a little while.
Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, also with us, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, co-author of Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Julian Zelizer, professor, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you see as potential problem areas for the Biden candidacy?
Well, clearly his record will be an issue. The Democrats have moved in a very different direction. They've grown over the decades. And some of his record on crime legislation, his role in the Anita Hill hearings, his positions that have come out on busing, all of this will be part of the primary debate. Where is Biden today on issues of race and issues that have been raised by the Me Too movement? And so that's going to be a problem for him. Second, he's run before and he hasn't done well. And so we have to remember that. There's been something about his campaign style that hasn't elicited great enthusiasm. And finally, he's entering a field with some pretty formidable Democrats. And even though he has the most experience and name recognition, I think there's a lot of candidates Democrats see who are exciting, who are charismatic, and who are going to give him a real run for his money now that he's actually in it.
Julian, I wonder about some of these things media brings up about busing, which was a divisive issue even among Democrats back at that time about the Anita Hill hearings. I wonder how deep does this concern really go? It's hard for me to tell how much of this is media driven and social media voices versus really deeply, deep concerns among rank and file Democratic voters.
Well, you have to remember, in primaries, the most active part of the party tends to be quite powerful. They're out there, they're organizing, they're mobilizing, they're deciding who to help and who not to help. And so it will depend how he deals with these parts of his record. I don't think if he just says the times have changed, and I understand that, it will be sufficient. I think he'll really need to lay out a compelling case about where he is on these questions, because I do think they will matter between now and Super Tuesday, in terms of his ability to attract support and to actually offer policy proposals that mean something, as a lot of Democrats are looking for a way forward after the last few years.
I guess to me, though, when I think of Obama's candidacy, it really wasn't his policy proposals that I think drove people out to the polls. It was him personally that commanded that sort of response. Matt, your thoughts about, how detailed or innovative does he need to be in proposals?
I don't, the issue is going to be more on a macro level. I think this race is going to play out on a macro level, which is we're seeing it already now. Republicans are trying to push the Democrats towards the socialist label, and there are going to be big questions, not so much on the minutia, but it's going to be things like Medicare for All, paying for student debt, what does capitalism mean in the modern society? I think Biden's got to find some way to thread those needles and say that I can handle the system that we've got, because you've got people in the race talk about blowing up the whole system. I mean, you've got literally that's what Bernie Sanders' entire campaign has been about, that we need some political revolution. And Elizabeth Warren is basically saying the same thing. He's going to have to find a way. The challenge he's going to have is that politics is all about looking forward. That's the point. The job is what the next job is going to be. That's the definition of a job, of a elected official's job. But his entire focus right now, at least, is looking backwards, not just for his 45 years, but really harkening back even to Obama. And even Obama's presidency feels like a million years ago now. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff Obama was saying back, I mean, he wasn't even for gay marriage back then. If he'd said that nowadays.
But Biden,
well, during the administration. But if you go back to the presidential, it would be almost like a hate crime nowadays if Obama said the things that he said around gay marriage. And that's just a decade ago. So Biden's got to find a way to both say, my experience gives me an opportunity to do something for the future and where I'm going to be. I think if he gets caught up in talking about busing from the 1970s or the 80s, he's going to go nowhere. He's got to find a way to say, my career is, we are at a continuum. All of the points that I worked at were points in time, but here's what I'm going to do moving forward in the future. And if you look at the polling in general, at least so far, the polls have not talked a lot about the identity issues or some of these other more hot button issues you see on Twitter or in the media that said who can win.
So you'd advise him not to go back too much. Don't spend too much time explaining.
He needs an answer for that. But if his whole campaign is going to be an apology tour, then he's never going to get out of second gear. And so he's got to now look, the good politicians are able to do that. And the presser brought this up. Biden typically has not been that great at the national level. So can you do it? You can do it. How you do it is going to take some maneuvering, and whether he has the talent to do that we're going to have to find that out.
Talking with Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, also with us, professor and historian Julian Zelizer of Princeton University. I'd like to hear from you, not who you would vote for. That's, I think, less interesting in terms of our conversation, but your analysis. We have so many smart Air Talk listeners very plugged into politics. What do you see as the strengths and potential vulnerabilities of a Biden candidacy? Right now, he sits as the front runner along with Bernie Sanders, and they're in the numbers pretty much head and shoulders above the rest of the field. Now, we haven't even gotten to the debates, and I think that is going to be very telling and have a huge effect on these numbers. But for where we sit early on, my question for you is, what do you think for Biden are going to be the potential strengths and potential vulnerabilities? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Professor Zelizer, I remember doing a lengthy interview with him back when Biden ran the second time for president. One of the things I so enjoyed talking with him was that he's very real. He didn't have what seemed like a lot of canned responses. If they were canned, he very effectively masked that in a highly personable style, something that if you interview a lot of politicians is very rare. But does that get candidates into trouble as well?
Well, sure. That's been part of his history. It's clearly a virtue, and people who have worked with him or people who've seen him speak love that dimension of him. He is a real person. He shows real compassion when he talks about issues or deals with individual problems, but that gets him in trouble. Often he'll go off script and he'll say things that will dominate the news cycle or which will reflect some of these underlying concerns about who he is and whether he's the right candidate. And now added to that is the physicality of everything that he does. So he'll have to be careful. You know, when you run for president, it's good to be authentic. It's good to be yourself. But there's a reason people are scripted, because mistakes can be incredibly damaging. He has learned that. That's, you know, part of his own experience running.
I wonder about African-American voters. The fact he's associated with Obama is positive, but in this party where so many of the candidates are of color, are younger, Matt, your sense of his appeal to African-American voters?
Well, I'm really interested in this because if you look historically at the party, Biden is the type of candidate that should have a lot of African-American support. He is, if you think of him as the establishment candidate right now, and I assume that he's going to try to take that mantle. And certainly people like Biden and Warren will help him do that, right? He's going to say, you know, like Walter Mondale was in this position, Al Gore was in this position against Bill Bradley. And so the challenge for Hillary was she was in a very good position with African-American voters because of her husband's history, both as president and the affection that community had, until it became clear that Obama could win. He won Iowa. He came very close to New Hampshire. And when he became a viable candidate. Now, whether you know those voters in the South right now who are giving him a lot of their votes right now, are they going to move to a Kamala Harris? Are they going to move to a Cory Booker? That's not historically necessarily been 100% true, but we're at a different time. So Obama was a very unique candidate. I think it's very difficult to look at Obama and say, well, they all moved to Obama. Obama is a very unique political talent and sort of unprecedented in a lot of ways in American history, certainly as the first African-American president. So Biden,
but his skill set is so high, it's hard to compare other people to him.
Yeah, it's just there's a lot of good major league pitchers who don't throw 100 miles an hour. Not everybody's Nolan Ryan. And And so I just think from a political perspective. So he's in a good position. Historically, somebody like Biden would do well. I am very curious to see, though, this party has changed, as the professor mentioned. And there's a lot of roiling from the activists saying that only, you know, there's this, almost a sense of only a kind of representative of this community, whatever community they're representing, can be the person to represent us moving forward. So Biden's going to have to challenge that. As of now, though, he's doing pretty well in those numbers, both in terms of, I think, his legacy as a politician and also with his time with Obama. And that's another needle he's going to have to thread, because he's got to keep those voters. That's the only way he's going to win this race.
All right. Julian Zelizer, as you look at matching up against President Trump, and you look at this field, which of the candidates do you think have the potential to have broad enough based appeal that they could unseat Trump?
Well, he certainly is one of them. I do think Senator Warren is another who has the potential to kind of bridge the Sanders and Biden voters and level a pretty effective campaign if she can get through the primaries. I also think Kamala Harris is a very formidable candidate, and she's showing some of what she can do on the trail in the last few weeks. So I think there's a lot of candidates who are electable and who can capitalize on his vulnerability. They will not only have to try to bring back those Democratic voters in Wisconsin, but they will also have to make sure that all those other Democrats, the ones who never flipped, are enthused and they're out there. They probably will be. But I think those are candidates who can tap into that.
And the distaste for President Trump is so strong among Democrats. Matt, can that be counted on to drive turnout regardless of who the nominee is?
It depends who the nominee is and where the race goes. But I think as of now, I would say yes. I mean, if you look at Trump, it's been difficult because Trump was such an unexpected victory. We're all sort of dancing on, you know, the head of a pin trying to say, well, even though his numbers are poor, he did pull it off last time. If you just look at historical point of view and don't look at Trump as a kind of anomaly that he seems to have been, his numbers are terrible. They have not been good. They've gone down even a little more since the Mueller report. We'll see if that stabilizes. But he's never even broken 50. So he, by definition, I think is going to be in a real dogfight of a race. All that said, Trump is a very dangerous candidate. When this becomes a one-on-one race, he's very good at finding the weakness of these candidates. The Democratic Party, this has the potential to be a very ugly primary. This could enter a lot of in terms of identity, in terms of past versus future versus white men versus. So there's a lot of ugly fault lines going on in the Democratic Party as well.
Which could turn people off.
Which could really turn people off and move people into Trump's direction. That's what, you know, Hillary did not have as divisive a primary. It was divisive with Sanders, not as divisive as I think this could get. But at the end of the day, she was a divisive figure by definition. If the Democrats have a particularly divisive primary that turns off a lot of voters, that could be problematic in the general election because Trump is very, very good at exploiting those weaknesses. So it's very difficult to say right now what the contours of the race are going to look like, you know, in a year or year and a half.
Matt, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure. And we'll talk with you a coming Monday soon.
I'm just going to get a hotel here, Larry.
I think that's a good idea. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, worked as a senior Obama advisor back in 2008, and historian and professor Julian Zelizer of Princeton University, co-author of Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Coming up on Air Talk, a bill that would allow state workers under a pilot program to bring their babies to work. That's right. We'll find out what that might bring. DMV office? I'm trying to picture that. We'll talk about that coming up in 1 minute right here on Air Talk. Well, the California legislature is considering a bill from San Diego Assemblyman Randy Vopel, which would allow state workers to bring their newborns to work. AB 372 would give parents and caregivers an option of bringing their babies into the state workplace starting at 6 weeks old, and they could remain in the office until they reach 6 months or begin to crawl. The Infants at Work pilot program would be voluntary for state agencies. Last year, it didn't get through the legislative process, but the assembly member is back with it yet again. Joining us from Politico's California Playbook, where he's co-author, Jeremy B. White. Jeremy, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this came around before, didn't get out of committee, but I'm just trying to understand how this might work, where you would have particularly state agencies dealing with the public, like the DMV, and you'd have people that are working there dealing with, you know, with these very young children. How would this work in practice?
Well, state agencies would have to opt into this. It doesn't mandate anything. It just allows workers at these agencies to bring their children to work. And I would just note, you know, politically, this is a bill that has some support from pediatricians and various other groups and doesn't seem to have any sort of organized opposition at this point, which, you know, if you're thinking about things, prospects in Sacramento is always a good place to look.
All right. And so without opposition, that might enable it to get out of committee this time. But has this been fleshed out to your knowledge with sorts of, you know, if could a supervisor, if it's not working, decide, hey, you know, this isn't going to work. You've got to find childcare or you've got to take a longer leave to care for your baby. What sorts of controls are there on this pilot?
You know, this would allow state agencies to sort of adopt the regulations that would shape the program. So I think it's a little hypothetical in terms of whether a supervisor could sort of dictate that type of thing. So I think that kind of remains to be seen. But I would note to your earlier point, it has passed its first committee.
Okay.
So it's now on to it's moving through the legislative process.
All right. Well, I'd love to hear from listeners. What do you think about this? Do you think that some state departments should allow infants to be brought into the workplace by a parent or caregiver? The child who would be at least 6 weeks old could be brought to the workplace, could be there until they reach 6 months or until they begin to crawl. Do you think that obviously would give a longer chance for the parent or caregiver to bond more hours of the day? If you've got a child that's being breastfed, there would be advantages in the child being on site. But your thoughts about having a baby in a work environment like that? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Perhaps at your place of work, you've actually done this and seen what the advantages or disadvantages are of bringing an infant into the workplace between 6 weeks and 6 months of age. 866-893-KPECC. Or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'm trying to think about how this would factor into workflow because obviously, you know, to attend to a child at that age, that in and of itself I think of as a full-time job. How you'd be able to balance that along with doing work, I can't imagine that I would be able to do it. Now, I know there are some parents much better at multitasking than I would be, but I would find that it just extremely difficult to be caring for my child and trying to work at the same time. I'm not even talking about being on the air, but just dealing with all the demands of a job. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jeremy, I know you're on deadline. I'm going to let you go while we talk with listeners. Jeremy, thanks very much. David in Monrovia, what do you think about this bill?
I think that bringing infants into a public space, particularly in the middle of a measles outbreak, is not real smart. And I think that it's another symptom of a society that works too hard and doesn't give people time off to take care of the kids.
Okay, so you would not be supportive of this. Can you imagine some jobs where it would make sense? I'm thinking, for example, you know, you got a small business or something, limited number of employees, maybe you're not interacting with the public. I could see where this could work, and with a parent who's particularly good at multitasking.
Well, absolutely. I own a small business. I have 6 employees, and I have offered one of my employees, you know, space for his partner to bring their infant in. What I heard on the segment was it was a state department, which would be a large public place.
Yeah, it is. It would actually be state of California departments. So like the Department of Motor Vehicles, it could be any one of the state departments that decides they want to participate in this pilot program. I appreciate your call, David, 866-893-KPCC. And speaking of children in the workplace, my son Desmond is going to join me in just a few minutes on Take Your Child to Work Day. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of being an only child. Both he and I are onlys, and I look forward to your joining me with your calls about that coming up in our next segment. Kate, in West Los Angeles, what do you think about State of California employees potentially bringing their infants to work?
I think this is a terrible idea. I'm a mom, and I think that it would be difficult for the mother to actually pay attention in her workplace and not be distracted by the child. I also think it's not a good idea for the child because the child doesn't have somebody paying 100% attention to them, and they're also exposed to lots of infections, particularly if the mother is working in a place where there are lots of people coming in and out. Those people, we've heard about measles outbreaks, and it would be really easy for the child to be exposed to infections and be at risk. And as an infant, that I just think it's a bad idea from both the mother's perspective, the workplace perspective, and the baby's perspective.
All right. And it could be dads, too. This would not be exclusive to women who are raising a child. It would be to a parent or caregiver. Kate, I appreciate it very much. Angela in Chatsworth, I understand you do this. How is it working?
It worked really well for me. I am fortunate that I work in a place that teaches parent-child classes. So we have children there anyway. But my boss actually allowed us to bring our children to work with us. I just wear my baby, like I put her in a baby carrier, and I'm able to interact with the parents and move about and pick up equipment and everything with her. And I did it with my son, who's three as well.
That's great. And did you feel like you were able to, I'm trying to think of the way of putting this, being flexible enough in your attention that you didn't end up, in a sense, neglecting the child or neglecting your work? You were able to attend to both at the level you needed.
Yes. I mean, of course, with everything, there are moments where it's a little bit more challenging than others. But for the most part, I was always able to balance the two. And, I've been teaching for a long time, so I know, okay, I might have a lull in the class right now, so this is a good time if I need to maybe nurse her in the carrier, or if I need to take a break and step aside while they're entertained on their own. And you just kind of figure out a way to balance. Mothers, kind of have to do that anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not hard to, it wasn't hard for me to work at work. And it did help a lot that I was working with other mothers and parents and, nannies, caregivers.
Yeah, because you could model how you're providing care to your kids.
Exactly. And they understood if there was a, if the baby was crying a little bit more or something like that, they understood, and we were able to make it work. And I'm very grateful that I'm in a position that I can do that.
All right. Angela, thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC. Ani, in Costa Mesa, what do you think about this bill, which would allow state employees to bring their 6-week-old to 6-month-olds to work?
Hi, Mary. I think it's a great idea. I agree with everything your previous callers have said, especially that last woman. And specifically, I think, a lot of people don't realize that if you have a working mother who's interested in breastfeeding her child, that requires a lot of time when she goes back to work, because she takes her pump to work. She has to find a place to pump several times a day, usually every couple hours. She has to find a place to clean that pump and store the milk and store the pump. And in the meantime, the baby's getting the benefits of breast milk, but not the breastfeeding directly from the mother. And so the idea of having that option of bringing your child to work would actually, I think, be a time saver in a way, because you're not worrying about storing that milk and finding a way to keep it fresh for your child. You can just feed your child right there.
Do you feel like in the work that you do, because I think you said you're employed out of the home, that you would have been able to do this with your kids and be able to attend to both?
Well, yes. I mean, I have the benefit of working from home because I have a solo practice. I'm an attorney and I have a lot of attorney friends who are mothers of young children who have gone through this in their own workplaces. Now, you know, if you're an attorney who's going to court, you know, that's obviously something that you have to plan for. But other than that situation, a lot of attorneys and a lot of people these days, their jobs involve sitting behind a desk and doing work at a computer. And in this environment like that, I think it would be, you know, really ideal to have the option, at least, of having your baby come to work. And again, it doesn't have to be an everyday thing, but the more you can do it, I think the better it is for the mother and the baby. And
all right.
The ability for the mother to have the option is a great idea.
Ani, thanks so much. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. Calvin in Torrance, what do you think about this proposed State of California pilot project?
I believe the project is interesting, but I believe it might be ineffective. I think work productivity will probably go down significantly. I was working full time and going to law school in the evening when I had a newborn, and on the weekends my wife worked sometimes, so I would bring the newborn to the library to study to see how well that worked. I tried twice, and that was very ineffective. They would sleep for a little bit, but most of the time they're awake and looking at the new surroundings, and there's no way to study when they're awake.
All right, Calvin, I appreciate it. Thanks. Natalie in West Hollywood, what's your opinion of the proposal to allow state workers to bring their infants to work?
It is clearly, it's proposed by a man who has never been postpartum.
Well, that's safe to say.
Yes. But in terms of the productivity, when you have a newborn, your mind is there. Your productivity for anything else is pretty much gone, unless the baby's sleeping, which is unpredictable. If the mother's been sleeping at night, that's highly unlikely because most newborns don't sleep through the night. So her productivity, even when she has a moment to work and think about the work, is not going to be effective. And we are in the middle, of a measles epidemic with a newborn that has limited, if any, immunity.
And in fact, a number of listeners have brought that up. Natalie, I appreciate your call. Let me share some other listener comments before we break for Hetty's update. Reagan in Hollywood says, I'm surprised about people being negative. I brought my kids at that age. If you work in the right office, I see no reason why you couldn't have your baby with you. Matt in Eagle Rock says, I've been taking care of my daughter since she's one. She's now five. I took her to work with me for 3.5 years. It does take a lot of balancing, but it can be done with good organization and preparation. And Matt in Glendale says, my mom had me when she was 19, took me to work pretty often. I think it really depends on the person. I turned out pretty well adjusted, Matt says. Thank you for those comments. You can share more on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. It's Take Your Child to Work Day. And coming right up, my son Desmond joins me for a conversation on the pros and cons of being an only child. He's an only, I'm an only. And with a live update, Hetty Lynn Hurdy's also an only child. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Today is Take Your Child to Work Day. The last time my son Desmond was on the air here was for Air Talk's 26th anniversary. It was April 1st, 2011. Our Air Talk staff decided to take advantage of April Fool's Day to prank me as I opened Film Week.
This is Film Week. I'm Desmond Mantle. Coming up on my daddy's show today, critics Claudia Puig and Andy Klein review Source Code, Insidious, and Hop. Dad, should we go and see this? Maybe not. Also, John Raby in conversation with Ron Perlman about making the 1981 cult classic, Quest for Fire. That's all coming up on Film Week. April Fool's, Dad.
Desmond was 9 years old. He got me good on that day. And on this Take Your Child to Work Day, John Raby suggested that I invite Desmond, who's now 17, to join me. And Des suggested that we talk about the pros and cons of being an only child. If you're an only, I would love to hear from you. If you're a parent of an only, what do you think are the advantages or potential pitfalls of being an only child or having an only child? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Good morning, son.
Good morning, Father.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. It's hard to know what you miss by not having siblings, but Do you ever wish you had a brother or sister?
No, and you've been asking me that since I was a little kid. The answer's consistently been no. I mean, I remember when I was a very little kid, and you'd ask me, you know, if you really, really want a sibling, I suppose we could consider it. And I always said, no, I don't really, really want a sibling. In fact, I don't even slightly want a sibling. I'm very happy being an only child, and that's continued through my entire childhood. I like the fact that I've lived in the same house, I go to the same school, I have the same family that's set up. That's very comforting to me.
Yeah, and so you don't feel like you miss kind of a buffer from your parents or having people in the house closer to your age who sort of give you more of a sense of what the peer world is like outside?
Well, that's definitely the biggest drawback. That's the thing I would mention is sort of a sense of peer, sense of age, perhaps even era in that sense. I'm missing a little bit of that. YouTube music thinks that I'm a 60-year-old man because that's what my music tastes are. Yeah. And I think, you know, I have you to blame for that primarily. But I like that music. You know, there are a lot of things I sincerely like that take me back to a different era. You know, the Jack Benny Show.
you're like your great-grandparents.
Well, exactly. Yeah. In that case, yes. But I mean, because I've had a constant influence of people far older than I was, you know, in terms of being adults and middle-aged adults at that, at least, rather than young adults or peers my own age in my house with me, definitely that's left me less able to intuitively understand things that are of nature in today's day and age. I don't have social media, and if I did, I'd have a lot of trouble being normal on it because I wouldn't have the sort of the checks and balances that siblings could provide on that.
Desmond Mantle, Kristen, my son, joining us for this Take Your Child to Work Day for this segment of Air Talk. The only child experience, if you are an only, I'd love to hear from you what you see as the pros and cons. Also, if you are a parent of an only, what do you think about it? Desmond, referencing something I think is another good point, is having a father who's older than average when he was born. I was 42 when Kristen gave birth to Desmond. So not only does he have the only child experience, but an older father as well, which probably factors into that, you know, dealing with adults versus dealing with peers. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Hetty messaged me, I desperately wanted a sibling when I was young. As an adult, I was so appreciative of the time and effort that was put into my upbringing and education. Hetty sharing that about her childhood experience growing up in New York as an only child. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. What do you feel you missed out on by being an only child? What do you feel was advantageous in the experience? There have been some interesting studies, for example, on onlys. University of Texas educational psychologist Tony Falbo said in her studies, only children are indistinguishable from firstborns and people from small families, but they did better than children who came from larger families. So, son, that's what I wonder about the trade-off, because when you're an only, you are the focus of parental attention. I had that with my parents. There's no one else, you know, to take that attention away from you. What's the downside of that?
Well, I actually do want to add one thing to that too, which is a difference that I have from you, and that's the fact that I'm not only my parents' only child, I am my grandparents' only grandchild, all four of them. I don't have any first cousins because you are an only child, and mom doesn't have any nieces or nephews, so that's left me with also four grandparents whose attention was all on me. And before my late great grandfather's passing, I was his only great grandchild because my maternal grandfather is an only child. So between all of that, you know, I had seven adults for whom I'm the linear descendant, the person carrying on the family name and whatnot. And definitely there's pressure involved with that. There's pressure in the sense that every bit of positive attention is matched with a feeling of scrutiny. And this says, you know, it's like I am the grandkid. I'm the kid. I'm the great grandkid. I'm the one to whom it falls to be a young person. And since I'm clearly not great at being a young person from having this constant older influence in my life, that's definitely a challenge that I've struggled to meet more. But I love the benefits of it. I think they outweigh it, really. I like the positive attention more than I dislike the scrutiny.
Desmond Mantle, Kristen, my son, joining me me today for Take Your Child to Work Day. Desmond suggested this topic, which we have not done for years on Air Talk. We've always gotten great calls, the pros and cons of being an only child. Matt, in Eagle Rock, you're a parent of an only?
Hi, this is Matt.
Yeah, hi. You're a parent of an only?
We are, and we are like you. My wife and I were on the older side, and so we thought, well, right away when my daughter could start talking, we said, would you like a sibling? And she has been a totally content to be an only child from day one. We've periodically asked her. Now that ship is sort of sailing, so now she's sort of locked in, I think, unless we were to choose adoption, of course, which is also a good option. And my last comment on this is, it's also a monetary issue. I think it's having one child is very realistic for most families now. And also it's an environmental issue. Statistically, just having more children is harder on the earth looking down the road with the global population increase.
Yeah, Matt, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. 866-893-KPECC. Cecilia in Pasadena says, I'm a parent of an only. My husband and I are a little older, decided to have a second child because we felt raising our kid as an only child with older parents would be tough. So we wanted to have a sibling to help him manage. Cecilia, I think that's a very common sentiment of parents being very concerned about having an only child because of fears that the child would not be as skilled in dealing with the peer group, that, you know, again, there's not a buffer necessarily with the parents. There's not the richness of the bonding experience. You know, I look at my wife who has two sisters, one older and one younger. There's a whole dynamic that she has in her sibling relationship that I'm just ignorant of. I see it from the outside, but being an only child, I have no experience with it. Desmond has no experience. We just look and see it from the outside. It's very rich. As an only, you don't have that. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Anna's wondering whether Desmond would like to meet her daughter. She's 18. Anna will have to deal with that later. 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. One of my theories, which I've talked with you about, Desmond, is I think how people feel about being an only child has to do in part with the relationship with parents because mm-hmm. you don't have a buffer.
Right.
If you got a prickly relationship with your parents, there's no one to you know talk through or you know complain about. And just what you see with your peers, your experience, do you think that that's true?
I'm sure that we have a more egalitarian relationship, I think, than a lot of families, you know, have in the first place, in the sense that I get a much greater say in stuff that happens in the family than I think is true among a lot of my peers, where you got multiple siblings. And if you tried to run it as a democracy, you'd constantly be running into 2-2 splits or whatever. It wouldn't be very feasible. And with just me being the kid, I'm able to both access the concentration of financial and emotional resources mentioned in an earlier call, but also to be able to that decision making. I am able to develop, and I think that developed my maturity for decision making too. Having that responsibility, that freedom, gave me a sense of how to make decisions about my own life and not have people my own age unduly influencing that. It made me a lot of the independent person that I am today. And I love the fact that I have such a close relationship with you and Mom. You're right. If it were rough, it would be really rough. I wouldn't have a very good escape for that. But because it's so good, I'm reveling in the fact that it's really a wonderful relationship.
All right. We'll continue our conversation. Desmond Mantle, Kristen and my son, Take Your Child to Work Day. John Raby made the suggestion that Desmond join me for a segment here on Air Talk. Only Children, the pros and cons of being an only child or parenting an only child. We'll talk with more callers at 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. I have to say, this is so fun for me to have our son Desmond join me for this segment of Air Talk. These are actually kinds of conversations we have at home all the time.
It is.
So doesn't it feel like kind of just we're you know, sitting at home talking about this. Desmond is with me on Bring Your Child to Work Day. I credit John Raby for a suggestion that I'm certainly enjoying. Having Desmond share his thoughts about being an only child. I'm an only child. Hetty's an only child. And Natalie, our producer, is an only child. And she says, you know, as an only child, as my parents get older, I'm thinking more about how I would take care of them. It would definitely be helpful to have siblings to share that financial and emotional responsibility. You know, it's a very good point. I was just up in Sacramento. My father had surgery. I was up there with him for that. And you know, there is no sibling to assist in that. Now, I'm very close to my father, and I enjoy spending time with him. So it certainly doesn't feel a burden. But I could see in some cases where if you're an only child with an aging parent, that could be a difficult circumstance. For me, it's a chance to spend time with my dad, even as he's going through what you know, maybe a challenging circumstance. 866-893-KPCC. Peggy in Manhattan Beach, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, I am the parent of an only son who is 33 years old now. When he was little, I felt that being an only child had a lot of advantages, not just in his life, but also in the family relationship. As he's gotten older, where I see a difference is I'm one of five children, and I feel that they miss the confidant part of a sibling relationship. And I don't think that his best friends fill that void the way a sibling does.
That's a really good point, Peggy. Thank you. I mean, it is by definition a different relationship. Desmond, as you see your friends at school, most of whom have siblings, you think that's the case?
I definitely do think that's the case. There's a lot of sibling confidant use, I'm sure, although I don't get to see a whole lot of that. But definitely I felt, I guess, kind of on the pressure end again of things. There's definitely been pressure to make friends, to have peers my own age to have as confidants because I don't have a sibling. That's definitely been the case. And to not only that, but to have really solid friendships. That's been something I've always had to strive for, because that was a way to have the sibling void filled to some extent. Going back to what you said, though, about parental responsibility, I was just thinking about this morning, when you become too old to drive safely, there's nobody else who can take the keys away from you but me, presumably.
Yeah.
Which is going to be nearly impossible.
I hope I'm going to be able to be honest with myself when I'm not safe to drive.
I think,
no guarantee.
No, I hope so, too. I do think that's an incredibly difficult – that's more difficult even than, you know, medical care. In my standpoint, it's something, because to have to take a passion away from you.
Yeah, because I love to drive
because
so
you love
much.
Driving. That's a good point. Yeah, it's going to be like taking the keys away from me when I'm old. I think there's a lot to be said for that responsibility being incredibly strong for kids where there isn't a sibling to share that. You can't play off each other. You can't do good cop, bad cop. You just have to be the only person to represent the interest of the family to the aging parent, and that's the struggle.
You will have your mom to help you in that.
Yeah, yeah.
In that. But I hear what you're saying. That's a very good point. Let's talk with Ken in Canoga Park. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. You know, there's a saying that says only is lonely. And when I was a kid, I experienced a lot of that. And because my parents spent a lot of time with their friends, I was around adults more than I was kids. So I actually started to prefer the company of adults, which I think helped mature me early. Now I'm an only child in my 60s, and I have a parent that is, I'm ending up being the only caregiver for. And it's very, very difficult. And having a sibling at this stage in life would be just a tremendous help, because the burden of doing it on your own, not only the finances, but
emotionally
and mental requirements, and still having your own life is really difficult without someone to share it with.
You know, Ken, another part of it is you don't have a sibling to sort of reality check your emotions or strategically how you want to deal with something with your parents' health. So I would think that makes it hard, too, because you're taking the weight of the decision and maybe second guessing yourself.
Exactly. If you had someone to vent to, just to vent and get rid of the frustration would be helpful. But also then to have the feedback of, you know, you're overreacting, or no, you're right. You know, you're not crazy to think that. that would be tremendous at this stage of life.
Ken, I appreciate it very much. Thanks for your call. Cassie in Redondo Beach, good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks so much. I think Ken just covered a couple of the points that I wanted to share. I'm an only child, and I'm a family psychologist, so I have a lot of opinions about this. But I think yeah. the first piece, and Desmond touched on this, was being around adults so often at holiday dinners and family functions as a young child, you really do develop strong communication skills, mature communication skills. That I don't think otherwise would have been developed if I'd been, playing with other kids and other things like that. Just the ability to communicate with people that are different from you, I think, is definitely the top pro and a benefit.
What's the other edge of the sword, the downside?
I think that there are two main things just based on my own experience and things I see clinically. The first being that not having peers, sometimes you don't develop skills related to negotiation and being able to just stand up for yourself in a lot of ways because you're not, learning those skills amongst peers. And I think the second bigger piece and more important piece is what Ken was just speaking about. When you experience traumatic life events, whether that be divorce, whether that be losing a parent, having a parent who's ill, not having that support system and siblings, that's a huge piece of it. And I think, I've seen friends go through this and I've gone through it myself. So I think that is definitely the other side of the puzzle.
Cassie, thank you so much. Appreciate both as a clinician and an only child yourself, your thoughts on that. There's some wonderful comments with people laying out personal experiences of being a parent of or being an only child themselves. Please take the time to go to kpcc.org, hit AirTalk, and you'll see it on the page. Desmond, thank you for coming on with me. This has really been fun.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it, too.
I appreciate it. We'll continue the conversation at home.
I'm sure
right.
we will.
Thanks. Desmond Mantle, Kristen, and myself. Joining me on Take Your Child to Work Day here on Air Talk. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll take a look at what's happening with the legal cannabis business. She's known as the Cannabis Czar, Lori Ajax. Heads of the Cannabis Control Bureau for the state of California. She has an extended segment coming up. We'll open up the phones, take your calls, and talk about some of the biggest challenges the legal marijuana industry is facing as the underground sale of cannabis continues strong here in the Golden State. But first, we look at a bill in Sacramento which would extend a ban on suspensions and expulsions of students who are defiant in class beyond third grade all the way through high school. Now, the LA Unified School District currently has such a ban on expulsions through high school, but if, like anything else, it comes with its trade-offs. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of how that policy plays out and whether it makes sense that all of California public schools, including charters, undergo this change and this limitation on what districts can do. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. I look forward to your thoughts on this. As a parent, as a former student, as a professional educator, what do you think about banning suspensions or expulsions for students who are defiant or disruptive in class? Kyle Stokes, KPCC K-12 education reporter, is with me. Kyle, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So how is this working out in LA Unified? What are teachers and administrators saying about
this?
Well,
so it has actually worked out better than it did in other places that have implemented these bans on suspensions for defiance. And I think we should back up and say the reason it's important that these suspensions are banned currently by LA Unified and some other major school systems have done this as well is because there is a lot of research to show that these suspensions for defiance, which basically is sort of a catch-all category, and in that sort of of subjectiveness of that category, the net that is caught by these suspensions tend to be, in California, the data show, black students tend to get suspended at disproportionate rates for defiance. And generally, their suspension rates are also higher even for other offenses. And so the push to ban this practice is meant to be sort of an equity move. And we have seen in the past other school districts, like in Philadelphia, there was a ban on suspensions for students for this purpose, and it was a disaster. There were a lot of misbehavior actually went up in schools. It led to a drop in student performance. But here in Los Angeles, we haven't seen those kinds of impacts. And there are certainly a lot of reasons why that's taken place. It's not been easy to implement. It's taken a lot of signaling from the top and a lot of push into efforts like restorative justice and going toward what's called the positive behavior intervention systems, or PBIS, behavioral supports for students. A lot of that has been in place. And in L.A., we have not seen at least the kind of worst case scenario that has played out in other large school districts that have enacted these bans out of this sort of very high minded purpose of equity, that we don't want to be pushing suspensions on the most vulnerable or underprivileged students.
Well, and it probably good to note that African-American students would be coming from homes that have, in many cases, fewer advantages of their counterparts, single-parent households, economic disparities, higher rates of drug addiction. I mean, all of these high stressors on kids who are going to school. And the question is, how are schools equipped to deal with that? So has LA Unified adapted to this in a way that they have programs to help intervene when kids bring the stress of home into the school?
Right. So back in, I believe it was 2013, and I might be misstating the year here, but the district enacted this ban on suspensions for defiance, but it was also part, I believe, of a broader push. I think it was called the School Climate Resolution. And, I'm kind of pulling this from memory here. My understanding is that in addition to saying we will not allow teachers to, if you can't suspend a student, if they bring a knife to class, obviously, they can be eligible for suspension. If they're bringing drugs, if they're fighting, things that are pretty black and white offenses, those can be suspendable. But defiance is now no longer one of those things. If that student is talking back to you.
So being disruptive, that's not enough.
Yeah, just being disruptive in the classroom, that's not an option anymore. And so they took that option off the table. But also the district very slowly has been sort of unfurling a restorative justice policy across the district. This is a sort of it's a very holistic approach to student discipline that starts before, discipline even begins, that attempts to address the root causes of, students' misbehavior by creating safe spaces within schools to talk about. I've been to these restorative justice circles where students sit around and they talk about a lot of different things, but basically just try and make it so that the school is a resource for them.
How do they do this when LA Unified has so few counselors? Because if you don't have people who are really expert in guiding those conversations, that could go off the rails pretty quickly.
Well, some of them are led by teachers. Some of them are led by administrators. There are different levels
of
circles.
So they're trained to do this?
Yeah, there is training that's what's been unfurling slowly, is that restorative justice has been being given to, slowly over the course of years. This cohort of schools is getting restorative justice training, then this cohort of school administrators, and sort of year by year. Now, one of the things that was important, according to some researchers I was talking with USC last year about this, completely, unrelated, essentially to today's show, but what they were saying was that the thing that was important here is that the district sent a signal from the top that it is important that you get your suspension rates under control in order for you to have more access to these types of trainings. And so there was a signal from the top that this is important to us, from, LAUSD's headquarters down to the schools. That message is the reason why the ban on these, suspensions for minor offenses has, at least hasn't played out in a worst case scenario, like as what I mentioned in Philadelphia.
So the question is, what's the effect on the classroom experience for the other students when you don't have a policy that allows for expulsion or suspension of students who are disruptive? I'd love to hear from you if you're a parent of a child in a school district where this has been an issue of kids that have been disruptive in class, if you have a child who has been suspended or expelled because of in-classroom conduct, your thoughts about how the school handled it. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You know, I have to say, from my LA Unified student days, you know, back, the thing that bothered me so much was you know, then they didn't suspend the kids that were disruptive. They tried to, you know, intervene everything. But it was really hard for the rest of us. It wasted our time. It was it made school even more boring than it already was, which is saying something. But yeah, it made it a more negative experience than it already was. And I just wonder for the kids who were in the classroom, if you're having to deal with sort of, you know, the student is still in the classroom being disruptive, that's got to be disheartening.
Right. I mean, and that is what you hear from people who I think they're, to be fair to the people who would argue that there are a lot of problems with this, is that because this has been framed in such a racial justice inequity lens, it feels like, you know, a little bit impertinent to say, hey, wait a minute, there are some problems here. But there are some real world challenges for teachers here. And, you know, when you look at how the State Teachers Association has approached legislation to ban these suspensions statewide K through 12.
Yeah, what's their view on?
Their view has been essentially to, you know, they'll take a step back. They don't support, they don't oppose, but their position is essentially that any kind of ban has to be accompanied with the same kind of training and resources from the state level, direction that signals, you know, sort of like in LA Unified, it signaled from the state level, and not just with a mandate, but with training and resources to help people. And if it doesn't come with that, it really can lead to difficult situations for teachers.
And you're going to end up with teachers disheartened and leaving the profession, or, you know, moving to other teaching situations.
But we should also mention that this is just for suspending students. What advocates would say who support banning these suspensions for minor infractions is that you could still remove a student from the classroom without suspending that student.
Good point.
And so that's sort of the distinction that's important to draw.
We're talking with KPECC, K through 12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. Also with us is Josefina Ramirez-Natsina, who is senior associate at Children Now, the advocacy organization. They're a co-sponsor of the bill. Ms. Natsina, thank you for being with us.
Hi, happy to be here with you.
What about is there money for the districts for training for this that's included, or would the districts just have to commit they're going to provide that training?
So last year's budget, separate from this legislation, last year's budget provided some funding for restorative justice education for school districts. So there is an attempt to ensure that more districts and administrators, you know, have access to continue to make investments in research-based practices through, you know, the multi-tiered system of support, through different grant funding, to talk about providing education around a school climate and discipline to support our kids. Children Now has been a member of the Fix School Discipline Coalition, along with multiple co-sponsors, the Alliance of Boys of Men in Color, Policy Link, Public Counsel, Youth Justice Coalition. And this bill has been supported by over 25 civil rights and education equity organizations. You know, I think that the time is now to ensure that our kids, that this subjective defiance and disruption suspension is eliminated. Some of the issues, failure to follow directions, bring materials to class, talking back, chewing gum, it's been very subjective in the past. And we know that when kids are not in the classroom, it's two decades of research show that responding to these policies when kids are not in the classroom, they're more likely to drop out of school, three times more likely to come into contact with the juvenile justice system. Keeping kids in school is more effective at reducing violence and minimizing the negative effects and the long-term costs of youth alienation.
Have they studied what the effects are of disruptive children in class to the other students?
So, you know, I think I would have to get back to you on that.
Because that to me would be, I mean, like everything else, again, it's a trade-off. This right. policy potentially has negative consequences for the kids who are not disruptive. So it'd be interesting to know what effect educationally, you know, for classes where you've got chronic disruptions, what is the effect on the other students? Because that would then give you a good comparison. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Donna, in Mid-City, Los Angeles, I understand you have a child in an LAUSD magnet.
That's correct. It is an extremely challenging program, AP biology in seventh grade. And my understanding is that the magnets are a privilege option. And I am not against the ban on suspension, but I've yet to hear anybody talk about those other kids. And I know you keep bringing it up, Larry, but my kid's one of the kids who's having trouble keeping up, as is most of his class, because they can't move quickly enough through the material because of the disruptions of two children. Two children now for 2 years are an ongoing disruption and preventing the program from moving forward.
Yeah. So this sounds, Kyle, like an example in LA Unified where there either isn't the training of the faculty or the intervention isn't effective. And it sounds like the students are staying in the class.
Yeah. It's a huge district. There's a lot of variation in how this is carried out. There is not evidence that I know of, like, that it has caused additional, fights. It's hard to know what the sort of on the ground, you know, reality is in every school. But I know that this is, you know, the caller is bringing up exactly the issue here, which is that if you take away a tool that teachers say they need to keep order, then that can lead to some real disruptions as well. It's a really difficult issue, and it's a really difficult balancing act between this very important equity issue to making sure that the rights of the students who aren't disrupting classes are also respected.
And there's not going to be any advocacy group necessarily for that population, because there are all kinds of advocacy groups try and bring about justice for.
On the other hand, but I'd have to push back on that a little bit, because do they need an advocacy group? I mean, these are students who, when you are acting out in school, it's often out of a reason that there are issues coming in from outside of school and in your life, socioeconomic stressors, violence.
That,
and so, I think that the issue there is that. The students who the public education system exists to serve all students. And at a certain point, I think what an advocate would say in this moment is that it's the students who don't have the ability to make up for that in class who need to be to have public school there as a resource. We can't be taking them out of the environment where they're most likely to get help.
So, Donna, what would you say to that as a parent of a couple of kids? Or, I'm sorry, one child.
My first question is, if my child, we're traveling cross town to get to this school to have my son be challenged. And my feeling is that child is in the room disrupting. Why isn't he forced to go back to his home school? And at the home school, why aren't, or at our school, why isn't there a linear system for how to get them disciplined and either back in line, or what is the consequence? These aren't hypothetical questions. My kid lives with this every day.
All right, Donna.
Just to be clear, I'm a Latino. I get this. I grew up in the projects. I get it. But we have to have a real answer for what will be done.
Yeah. No one's making the argument kids are disruptive or just mean bad kids. We all accept the fact that they are acting out based on circumstance they face. The question is, what is the most equitable way for everybody to deal with that? 866-893-KPCC. I'd like to hear your opinion on that. We'll continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're looking at a bill in Sacramento which would extend, just as LA Unified has, a ban on suspensions or expulsions for students who are disruptive in class. Kids who, you know, physically attack other kids, bring weapons again, they could still be expelled or suspended. But a child who is disruptive, won't follow the teacher's directions, talks back to the teacher, interrupts constantly, that student would not be able to be suspended or expelled. She or he could be removed from the classroom. They would undergo ideally some sort of conversation, some sort of process to help get at the root of what's going on with them. The question is that happening in LA Unified? Is this something districts are able to take on? And what are the effects of such a ban on suspensions or expulsions for disruptive behavior on the totality of the classroom? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jocelyn tweets at AirTalk, my cousin who's non-ambulatory barely speaks and is in a wheelchair with cerebral palsy. She was actually sent home for willful defiance. It's used against even differently abled students and should be tossed out. Let's talk next with Elizabeth in Fullerton. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, my comment is I do not agree with the comment of your guest who said, you know, rhetorically, do students that are able to keep up and that students that are not having behavioral issues need an advocate? And the answer is yes, they absolutely need an advocate. I have a lot of teachers in my family and around the dinner table. We often hear that sometimes two or three students will absorb, you know, 70% of the teacher's time and attention. And there is a loss to the general education population that is struggling to maintain performance in the face of disruption and just the face of the fact that the teacher isn't just as accessible as they might be in other, you know, if the circumstances and the dynamics in the classroom were different.
All right. Elizabeth, I appreciate your call. Elizabeth in Fullerton, KPCC reporter Kyle Stokes covers K through 12 education. Kyle, anything just to follow up on that?
Yeah, I think that this is just a very difficult issue because you are weighing the people, you know, there is a question of what happens when you keep these students in school. I think that the thing there is so much research to suggest that suspending these students causes harm
to
the students who are suspended for these sort of borderline infractions. And so, you know, the question is, can schools be able to develop the resources to make sure that teachers are trained, that classroom climate is still maintained? But also, you know, there is an issue that I'm sure that our guest can also speak to about, like, how these suspensions can track students into the criminal justice system. There's so much research about that, and I think that the trade-off here is really a difficult one to navigate.
Yeah, I mean, that, of course, the question is it causal? I mean, there is an association, but you don't know whether it's the home life which causes the kids to act out, which puts them in the criminal justice track, or acting out at class and having a result in the school. That's difficult to get to. Paul in Hawthorne, I understand you worked for 5 years at LAUSD as a teacher administrator. Paul, what do you think about this bill?
Well, I am not in support of it. I have worked with LA Unified for about 30 years as a classroom teacher. Our students need to understand there is a consequence for their actions. When these same students graduate, they cannot take instruction from police officers or supervisors. The problem becomes much bigger than we originally thought planned. So we're just pushing the can down the road. We have to teach our children that when they misbehave, there's a consequence. The parents have to be part of this consequence. It's unfortunate that the teachers, everybody tell the teacher, you can't make the student stand up. You can't suspend the student. You cannot have detention after school. But for goodness sake, what consequence does the teacher have?
All right, Paul, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC. Seth in Glendale, what do you think about this bill that would ban suspensions or expulsions for disruptive classroom behavior?
Yeah, I wanted to say that when I was a child in fourth grade, I was a problem student, and instead of kicking me out of class or suspending me, they addressed the issue by determining what was my problem. I had a learning disability. They addressed the problem, and I became a straight-A student. So dealing with the student's problems instead of just kicking them out is a much better solution.
Did they threaten to kick you out when you were in fourth grade, Seth, or you know, or did they just right away go to try and assist you in what you were dealing with?
At first, I was sent to the principal's office here and there, but once they realized that this was a repeated issue, they brought my parents, my mom specifically involved, and they addressed, they looked into what could be the problem, as opposed to just writing me off.
Yeah. All right. I appreciate it, Seth. Thanks very much. Stephen East Hollywood says, I'm concerned parents are going to pull their kids out of public schools, put them into private schools, and it's going to further the stratification in education. Mark in Pasadena says, similarly, people choose private schools because public schools and classrooms are disruptive. Robert in Lawndale says, I think this bill is trying to do everything for all parties. It lacks detail and pragmatism to address the question. Disruptive kids do take away from other kids, but they have a right to free and equal education. Does the tail get to wag the dog? And Jimmy in Long Beach says, I was a disruptive student, and where I didn't get spent, I had a handful of teachers that worked with me and helped me channel my feelings. The kids that do disrupt need advocates to help them. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Josefina Ramirez-Natzina of Children Now, which co-sponsors this bill. You think it's likely that this time around this bill is going to pass?
Definitely. We think that there are there's quite a bit of research that says that this bill is striking an appropriate balance by reducing the suspensions for minor acts of disruption that perpetuate the pipeline to prison while continuing to protect the learning environment, since teachers are still able to suspend from class for up to 2 days and also maintain the ability to suspend when students materially disrupt or create substantial disorder. In addition, as of July 2017, the California Teacher Credentialing Standards require all new teachers and administrators to receive training on evidence-based alternatives to punitive discipline practices. There's still multiple grounds for suspension and expulsion, but this bill is hoping to curb the bias and the, you know, the research that tells us that Black students are more than four times as likely to be as suspended as white students, even when accused of similar behavior. And Latino students, and like someone's mentioned, students with disabilities are also facing disproportionate suspension. So we're hopeful that this bill and the education and awareness that we're trying to raise through the works of, work of the Fixed School Discipline Coalition. And you know,
all right, I'm sorry I got a break, but thank you so much. From Children Now, Josefina Ramirez, Natsina, Kyle Stokes, KPCC, K-12 reporter, thank you for joining us as well.
You're
welcome. Appreciate it. Again, you can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. And Kyle's going to be back Monday hosting for me in my stead on Air Talk. Kyle will be hosting the program, so you can hear him very, very soon, as well as all his reporting here on 89.3 KPCC. KPCC covers a lot of what's happening, of course, with the legalization of cannabis here in California, but nothing's better than getting the director of the California Bureau of Cannabis Control, Lori Ajax. Lori, thank you so much for joining us again on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me. It seems like it's been a long time.
I know. It's been too long, but we appreciate your coming on. First of all, I just want to talk generally about efforts to, for lack of a better term, cultivate the legal market for cannabis, because we keep hearing that the underground market continues to thrive because of its price advantage. Do you see the legal market making progress against the underground market?
I see every day we're making progress. Sometimes I don't think it's as quick as everybody would want. But, you know, from our standpoint, all of us at the state, I mean, it's a continuing. It's a battle every day to eradicate the underground, the unregulated market, to get them licensed. So our efforts are always to educate. We're educating consumers. We want to direct them to the licensees that are getting their product tested, that are paying their taxes. And so we just launched a public awareness campaign over the 420 weekend. So you're going to see a lot more of that education. We got to continue licensing people. We can't stop licensing folks that want to get regulated, but we've also got to continue working aggressively with our local jurisdictions to really, for lack of a better word, weed out those that don't have any intention of getting a license. So that is a huge focus. That's our focus and priority every single day.
We have the L.A. City Attorney's Office going after a South L.A. Commercial cannabis business for allegedly operating illegally and selling cannabis that's alleged to contain a dangerous pesticide. The city is looking at $20,000 a day penalty for the allegedly illegal shop. How frequently are cities like Los Angeles going after dispensaries allegedly operating illegally?
I think it depends on the jurisdiction and what ordinances they have in place. But we are our team at the Bureau. We're always working with the locals and assisting them in any way. As you know, we are overseeing the testing laboratory. So we're holding them accountable, making sure that failed product that, you know, has pesticides is not getting to retail. So, you know, it's always and the good news is that the more we keep more regulations, we've had a lot of regulations on the testing labs, but I think we're getting to a place where the testing labs are doing really well. And we continue to see the failure rate go down, which compared to last year at this time, we were looking at just about a 20% failure rate for all sorts of things, whether it was pesticides or contaminants or mold. And we're down to just a little over 10%. So things are improving
That's
on progress. That front.
Yeah. We'll continue with Lori Ajax, who heads the California Bureau of Cannabis Control. And I'd like to hear from you, VeriTalk listener, questions that you have for Ms. Ajax about her bureau. Also, I'm just wondering, you know, how much of a premium are you if you're a recreational cannabis buyer? How much of a premium are you willing to pay for tested legal cannabis versus buying it from, you know, an under the table underground supplier? How much of a premium are you willing to pay percentage wise to have stuff you know has been tested and certified? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Recreational legal cannabis, our focus, with the state regulator who heads up the bureau responsible for overseeing cannabis here. Lori Ajax joins us regularly on the program. We're taking your calls, your questions or comments. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Dion in Desert Hot Springs, good to have you with us. Your question for Ms. Ajax.
Thank you. I am calling because, like, Desert Hot Springs, cannabis is our leading industry in Desert Hot Springs. But I was wondering if there are any plans in the works to either rate like the restaurants do, like with the A's, B's, C's, D's, so that we know instantly before walking into one of these places if they're licensed or not.
Ah, Dion, appreciate it. Lori, is there a way of differentiating who's legal, who's not?
Yeah, Dion, that's interesting you say that, because there's a bill in the legislature right now to have a program where we'd have there'd be some sort of signage so people know when they're going to a legal retailer. And so for right now, the only way you would know is if you go on our website and do a license search. So, I think it's a great idea. And so we might be seeing something like that in the future.
All right, Dion, thanks very much. Jane in Culver City, good to have you with us.
Hi. My understanding is that cannabis delivery services are not subject to the same track and trace quality assurance mechanism that cannabis retail stores are. So my question is, if delivery becomes sort of ubiquitous throughout the state, doesn't the potential exist for contamination of product and other things that wouldn't pass if it went through a track and trace?
Lori Ajax.
Yeah, so our delivery licensees, retailers, they go through the same standards as a storefront retailer. So any product they're delivering has to be tested. There's a lot of strict regulations on their vehicle. They have to have a GPS. They have to have a real-time inventory. They have to check ID to make sure the folks that they're delivering to is 21 years or older. So they are subject, and they have limits on how much they can carry in their delivery vehicle. So they are really highly regulated, just like our retailers are.
All right, Jane, I appreciate it. Since Jane brought up delivery, it'd be good for us to bring up Weed Maps, which is the app that enables people to see where cannabis is being sold, which I don't believe differentiates between unlicensed and legal ones. I know that the Bureau told Weed Maps to cease and desist advertising illegal cannabis businesses. What's happening with that, Lori?
So you're right. We did put Weed Maps on notice, and they are continuing. We see other internet platforms, not just Weed Maps, that are advertising both licensed and unlicensed activity. In our final regulations, we did put some language on how you can be a legal internet platform. So we're, it's a huge challenge for us. And so we're continuing to find ways that we can maybe get people to really come to the state to find, to find legal retailers. And so I think that's going to be part of our public campaign. How do we be more, how are we more interactive with the public to get them to the licensed retailers and really sort of change people's mind that to get them from going from the unlicensed to the licensed retailer. So we've got some work on our part to continue to work on that issue.
And again, I'd love to hear from listeners. What would convince you if you still get cannabis from an unlicensed or illegal supplier? What would make you purchase legally? Is it a price issue for you? Is it you have a supplier you have trust in, so you're not concerned about contamination? What is it that would convince you to shift to purchasing through legal channels? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lori Ajax, how are you making that case for customers to pay the premium to purchase legally?
Well, again, it's like when people buy produce that's organically grown, it's really changing the mindset and really making sure people understand when they're paying more what they're getting for that. They're getting cannabis that's, gone through the supply chain legally. You're buying from people that are paying their taxes, that are following the rules, that are following some strict testing regulations. So when you can be assured that when you go to a licensed retailer, you're getting safe cannabis. And that really is something I think we're trying to educate more. And off, as I said earlier, we need to have variety out there. So I think the more people we get licensed, the more jurisdictions that allow commercial cannabis activity, where we can get, licensees all over the state and they can have a variety of products. But with that, we have to continue licensing people.
Speaking of licensing people, there were $10 million in equity grants. This designed to, try and get diversity within the legal cannabis business, people who might have been working in the unlicensed part of it or underrepresented. But those grants were canceled about a month after they were announced. What happened there?
So the equity grants are still there. The money is still there. And it's this money is so extremely important to local jurisdictions and our equity applicants. So we pulled it back. We're refining the application. So that money is going to be available for locals to apply very soon. So I would say to your listeners, stay tuned. And if you're not plugged into we're on social media. We have a listserv. And anytime we have an announcement, it goes out on our listserv. So I would encourage people to sign up so they get those announcements.
All right. Brian in Echo Park says, what's being done to provide more places for recreational users to choose and use products? Where can we smoke if we don't have a house or, you know, place that we can go? Lori Ajax?
So you're starting to see some of our cities that have really comprehensive regulations in place allow consumptions at their retail locations. And so you're starting to see more of that. So
I think West Hollywood's really embraced that, if I'm not mistaken.
They are. And they have a bill right now to have places where people can, you know, have coffee and consume cannabis. And so those things, you're seeing different business models pop up from the locals. So on our part, consumption on licensed premises has to be approved by the local jurisdiction. So we just provide whatever support we can. And of course, it's always working with our local jurisdiction. So I think as you see us move, you know, we're in second year of implementation. I think you're going to see those business models popping up more and more in our cities and counties.
Dan in Whittier, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lori. Given the significant growth of indoor growing in Southern California, what is the Bureau's position on sustainability requirements in terms of energy, water, and waste? Because energy can take up to 40% of indoor growing. So I'm curious to hear what the input is from your Bureau in terms of regulating that or at least having some parameters established.
Yeah, and Lori, your Bureau doesn't handle the cultivation side of this, does it?
That's correct. That's with the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and I know they work on this issue a lot, and they study it. And so I would, you know, if you go to our cannabis.cia.gov, there's a ton of information out there, but there's also contacts for like Department of Food and Ag, and they'd be happy to answer your questions.
Stephen in Lakewood, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, how are you doing today, Larry?
Good, doing great. So share with us, you wanted to comment about what would make you buy more consistently licensed cannabis. What would be the decider for you?
So I buy from two different dispensaries, one in Long Beach and one in towards Los Angeles. I just noticed that that one of the ones, one of the dispensaries here in Long Beach had a 33% tax. As where the unlicensed one, supposedly everything is already included in the price, which actually makes it a lot cheaper as well. I feel like maybe if the tax was possibly lowered on the legal standpoint, there'd be a lot more revenue coming in that form.
Could you put a percentage on it that you would be willing to pay more in taxes to have a certified, tested product?
I'd probably say anywhere between 8 to 10% would probably be a good tax rate.
Stephen, appreciate your call. Lori Ajax, that obviously less than the current tax.
Yeah, you know, every day that's a big concern from the industry and consumers is the taxes, because not only do you have the state taxes, each local jurisdiction can have taxes also. So I think that is a valid point on how high are people willing to pay for these taxes. So I think that's another thing you're seeing in some bills at the state legislature right now is looking at trying to lower some of those taxes or even suspend them for a period of time.
All right. We'll continue with Lori Ajax. She heads the California Bureau of Cannabis Control. She's taking your calls with your questions. Excellent input. One of the questions I'm asking is how much of a premium you're willing to pay for a taxed, legal, tested cannabis product versus buying from an unlicensed or underground facility, either someone you've been used to buying from over the years or a brick and mortar unlicensed shop. 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about legal recreational cannabis here in California with the person who's responsible for the state's administration of it, Lori Ajax. She's the director of the California Bureau of Cannabis Control. Let's see, we have Safari Bear writes on the Air Talk page, is there any legislation contemplated to limit advertising of cannabis similar to tobacco? Is anyone concerned about how the ads would affect our youth? Lori Ajax?
You know, I'm not quite sure if there's probably about 50 or 60 current bills on cannabis right now. I'm not quite sure if it addresses that specific advertising question, but we do have some pretty strict advertising rules in our regulations. I think there are a lot of people who are concerned about smoking and how it relates with tobacco. But I think that's something probably to check in with maybe your local legislator if they really have some good ideas on how we could do a better job with that.
Ryan in Fountain Valley, welcome. What would make you use a licensed taxed product versus unlicensed?
It would. I would disagree with the other caller as well. Just a lower tax, something equivalent to, you know, at least like alcohol. The current tax almost seems like a vilification, you know, and I'm the product. I go to I guess what they call them churches, which I don't know if they're legal or not legal, but they've been there a long time. And you can get, you know, like a vape product in either one, legal or not legal, which is identical because it's a package tested vape product. And in the legal, quote unquote, legal one, it's twice the price. The tax is just really crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So you go to one of those churches that claims it's exempt because of its religious standing. Ryan, does the safety issue enter into it at all? I mean, particularly given that some of these products, some of the cannabis itself, has failed because of pesticides and other contaminants.
I personally think that's true, but I think it's a very limited case and it's pushed out there a little too much, and it possibly is pushed out there too much because that's the only basis for a case for the tax. But I mean, just from my experience from the two shops and then legal shops, because I did try and go legal.
Yeah.
The flower is identical. And especially once you get into the vape stuff, which is tested, packaged, labeled, it's identical. So the safety is not it. It's purely, and maybe that's in Orange County where the product is maybe superior and it's safer, especially with the churches. I don't know, but it's really purely the tax.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan, I appreciate that. It's the cost, the price tag. Lori Ajax, can you speak to that issue? He says the product is really the same.
Well, I don't know because I don't know where he's going to get his product, and it's possible they could be licensed. Without knowing more, it would be hard to know. But I think a lot of this product that you're finding in the unlicensed market, it hasn't been tested and we don't know where it's coming from. So, you know, of course, I'm going to tell you, go to the regulated market. And by the way, Larry, I failed to mention when we introduced our public campaign last weekend, we have a new way of searching for a license, and it's at CAPotCheck.com. We're trying to make it easy for people to find us and find a licensed retailer. So CAPotCheck.com.
Okay, we're going to put that on the Air Talk page, our segment page. So if you're driving around, you don't have a chance to write it down, or you've got short-term memory complications like me, you can use the segment page for – it's just capotcheck.com, is that right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, what do you
Very
think
good.
Of that? See,
sounds
not
good.
Not too bad.
I'm used to these state websites that are so long no one could ever remember it. All right, 866-893 KPCC. Jordan in Woodland Hills, good to have you with us.
Hey, good to talk to you, Larry. Yeah, I was just wondering, as somebody who works in the marijuana retail storefront, what the state's doing to work on lowering taxes, because that's a constant complaint that we hear from customers is like, oh my God, 24% tax. And also, you know, just seeing how marijuana is taxed multiple times before it even gets to the customer. So what is the state doing to kind of work on that to bring more business in? Because we love, you know, people buying legal, regulated, tested cannabis.
All right. Lori Ajax.
Yeah, so the taxes, the state taxes are outlined in the current statute. So in order for the taxes to be changed, that has to happen at the state legislature. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a current bill looking to, I believe, lower the excise tax and also suspend the cultivation tax. So that's one of the bills to keep a lookout for.
One of the challenges is one of the selling points of legalizing recreational cannabis was the tax revenue that could bring in that would pay for the oversight. You know, your bureau, Lori, and the oversight of legal cannabis, that was all sort of part of the pitch. If you're going to significantly cut the taxes, are you concerned, Lori, that could undermine the legal framework?
You know, I think it really for the Bureau and the other two licensing authorities, our funding comes from our licensing fees. So we're not reliant on the taxes coming in. But, you know, I think we've got to strike a balance. We want more people to come into the regulated market. So I think there needs to be a balance on how much they're paying. And, you know, as we're hearing from your listener, I mean, I think it is really tough when sometimes these price tags get really high. So hopefully we'll strike that balance. And we'll get there. Right. I we're constantly, you know, I think government just needs to be flexible. And I think that's the word of the day when it comes to regulating this industry.
Lori Ajax, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. She is the chief of the California Bureau of Cannabis Control. And I'm sorry, there's some other great questions on the line. We just ran out of time for them. Please, next time Lori's with us, share those questions with us. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.